From WXXI News, it's Innovation Friday on Connections. Thanks for staying with us in the second hour of Connections. And we're sort of staying in the Healthcare Affordable Care Act windscreen just for the moment, and happy to be joined in the studio by Eric Bond. Thanks, Eric, for coming in. Great to have you with us. Eric is the CEO of Bond Financial Networks and also a member of the Rochester Business Alliance. And Eric, you're here to talk about the RBA's 2014 Health Benefit Survey, which is the 16th one that the RBA's run. Tell us a little bit about what the survey is intended to sort of capture in the business community here in Rochester.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here. The survey is really a way to reach out to the members and get the members to share information about what they're doing. Everyone is looks at healthcare a little bit differently. It's great to have ideas as to what other employers are doing, how they're dealing with the strategies of taking care of those higher costs that they're seeing year over year.
Right. What would you see as the kind of key points, findings of this current round in the survey this year?
I think some of the key drivers are issues that are a result of the Affordable Care Act. We see employers spending more money towards a single plan rather than the two-person or a family. A lot of that is driven by the fact that employers are trying to make their coverage affordable. And from a legal standpoint, affordability is measured on what is the cost, what is the employee's cost for the lowest price single plan.
Right. So, and my colleague Michelle's going to jump in just a second. The real cost of business, I mean, the cost to business of the employer mandate, how much of a preoccupation is that for businesses at the moment?
I think it's a fairly significant amount. Healthcare cost is one of the biggest cost items after payroll that employers have to deal with. So it takes a lot of attention. And it's not just the hard dollars, the cost of premium, but it's also the cost of doing the reporting, the tracking of data, and just the time that's spent figuring out how to deal with it all.
Yeah, there's a huge cost in just that paperwork portion, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So what percentage would you say that is? You said it's a huge cost, but is there an average percentage of what that costs most businesses in our area?
I think the survey indicates that it's about 9% of your payroll. Obviously, that's going to vary based on the type of people that you hire. If you have only highly compensated people, your percentage would be lower because healthcare tends to be more of a fixed cost. But that gives you an idea of the magnitude of that.
Yeah. We talked a lot in the last hour about what healthcare costs, but mostly we were talking about the cost to consumers, the healthcare consumer. But employers are also dealing with high costs. And at the Rochester Business Alliance Health Conference yesterday, they said exactly what you were just saying a moment ago, that that's the number one concern of most of the members. And that's why they have this survey, and that's why they had the conference yesterday. Yesterday at the conference, one thing that I found very interesting and not something that I had expected to hear was some conversation over whether or not the employer mandate would stand. Now, there are lawsuits against the employer mandate, but why, from your perspective, are so many employers against that mandate?
I think that it's the huge impact that it has on their business. So again, it's not just the cost of healthcare, but it's impacting, how you track people's hours, what kind of benefits they have in general. So it's impacting their business in a lot of different ways. That is one of the reasons that they're getting so much pushback. I think one of the faults of the Affordable Care Act is it created a new system rather than working within the system that we already had.
But the interesting thing is we nearly already had a system where employers were providing benefits. I mean, what really has changed when the majority of employers were providing benefits, continue to provide benefits? For people who are listening who aren't business owners, what really changed?
Well, I think that there was ways to change the system, which would have been a lot easier. We could have just increased the eligibility for Medicaid benefits. And that would have been an easy way to capture most of the population that was uncovered. I think this is really part of a bigger picture. I think there are elements that would like to push us to a single payer system, and this is really the first phase in pushing us down that path in that direction.
Right, and we touched on that in the last hour as well, and the politically charged kind of conversations that are around that.
I mean, but that's an interesting thing that you mentioned that, because at the conference yesterday, more than one person said that are we moving towards a single-payer system? In our survey, WXXI.org, if you would like to take our survey, a lot of people are mentioning single-payer. And really, in a Rochester Business Alliance conference about healthcare, that was not something that I was expecting to hear. Why? Why so much talk about single payer in relation to ACA and employers?
I don't think necessarily that employers are in favor of that, but I think that's the ultimate goal. I think they're pushing us in that direction because there's the thought there that one big entity could be more efficient than a whole bunch of smaller entities out there. You know, it's big government versus small government. You know, it's not a right or wrong decision. A lot of countries around the world use a single-payer system, you know, a national healthcare system that works. The big question is, how do you change from the current system to that system? You know, right now, healthcare consumes about 20% of our economy. And if you go to make changes to that, if you move to a single-payer system, there's going to be a lot of people who will come out behind. Even with ACA, there's a lot of people who are are losing from an economic standpoint. You know, there are other people that are going to come out way ahead. You know, right now, the hospital systems in particular, you know, have a lot of wins under healthcare reform. They're the big players, and as you try to consolidate, that's where things are going to consolidate. The people who are going to lose are going to be people who are distributing the products. The individual practitioners is severely impacted by that. So it's going to change, especially in a place like Rochester, how we receive our health care.
One of the things that were the big things that came out of the survey was 76% of those who responded to the survey say that they offer one or more high deductible insurance plans, and that's a 5% increase over the year before. That's a trend that we're seeing across the country. From the business owners that you know in the Rochester area, what are the things that they're saying are really pushing them to more high deductible?
The drivers for high deductibles really cost. As premiums keep going up and people can't afford it, they need to offer a lower priced option. And that's really where the high deductible discussion starts. However, once people get into the high deductible plans and they understand the risks behind the high deductible, then it's going to fuel things considerably where people are going to be much more comfortable because it's really a risk decision. If the employee is going to take risk, the question is, do I want to pay a high fixed premium and not have to worry about that risk? Or am I willing to assume a higher level of risk, funded through an HSA, and keep my costs low over time? A couple years ago, when high deductible plans first came out, a $1,300 deductible was a scary thing for a lot of people. And yet today, we routinely sell plans with a $5,500 deductible and people don't blink. So the marketplace has changed significantly.
If you just joined us, Eric Bond is CEO of Bond Financial Networks, and he's also a member of the Rochester Business Alliance. He's in the studio, and we're talking about the Rochester Business Alliance's 2014 Health Benefit Survey. It was out this week, and there was a conference yesterday touching on many of these issues. If you're a business owner or you've got questions about employer-provided insurance, we'd love to hear from you. We've got some time to take your calls, about 20 minutes or so. So please get on the line now. Don't leave it till too late. 844-295-8255. 844-295-8255. Join the conversation. My colleague Michelle Faust here, who's doing a lot of the lead reporting on the Affordable Care Act and health insurance, is with me as well. So the comments from Kent Gardner from the who's the chief economist of the Center for Governmental Research, who was also commenting on the survey figures and was at the conference yesterday. As Michelle reported him, he's saying that he says that Rochester area is cheaper in terms of total health care, cheaper on the Medicare side, cheaper on the private insurance side, and we do have excellent health outcomes. So while you're looking at the costing in terms of business efficiency and the kind of effectiveness of that, he seems to be saying that there's actually some good news in this as well. Would you agree?
Well, I think there's good news in Rochester. Rochester has been a very efficient system for a number of years. Over the years, it's been a model that people have pointed to that kind of encouraged people to move towards a more controlled system. Because in Rochester, we had two players that really control the marketplace from a deliverable standpoint, from an insurance perspective. That has kept our costs down, But I think over time, the costs are starting to creep into the area. If you keep the costs down artificially low too long, then you start to lose providers because a doctor could open a practice in Buffalo or Syracuse and make more money.
Do you think that it's because they're artificially low? Because a lot of the things that were mentioned at the conference yesterday, Trilby DeYoung from Finger Lakes Health Systems was saying a lot of that has to do with the collaboration of the different healthcare workers and practitioners in the Rochester area, and also something called the Community Technology Assessment and Advisory Board, which they get together and decide basically whether or not we should use technologies. Is it more expensive than it is effective? And I wonder what you think about that.
Oh, I think that certainly has an impact in keeping our overall costs down. And that indirectly impacts the prices that the employers are going to pay. If we drive claims down, we're going to drive down the cost of the insurance product. So I think any of that collaboration has been a positive thing. There are some negatives that are out there as well. You know, with consolidation, you lose the marketplace advantage. Some of the services, just based on the way the system has been built over time, reimbursements are different depending on where that service is provided. So, for instance, if you go to a local flu clinic, that flu clinic might get $35 for the shot. That same shot at a doctor's office might be $50. At the hospital, it's $100. It's the same shot, but depending on who's providing that is driving some of those expenses.
That's right. Exactly what we were talking about.
At the end of the last hour as well. Just talking about cash incentives for a moment, Eric. So in the survey, just quoting your figures here, 23% of respondents provide an annual cash incentive ranging from $150 to $4,000 to employees who opt out of the employer's health insurance. So presumably they can take that cash to the market, try and get a better deal. The average is about $1,100, roughly speaking. Do you see that as a percentage? I mean, looking ahead to next year, I mean, is that that percentage of respondents providing that cash incentive? Do you think that will rise in the next year?
No, I think it'll be fairly level.
Okay.
And the reason for that is if I am going to introduce a product, a concept like that,
yeah.
The goal is if I have more people come off my plan, which is now a new expense, it has to be enough people to offset the expense of paying for the people who already don't take coverage.
Right.
And so it becomes a math problem.
Right, sure. But with smaller businesses, it's certainly an issue that's come up in our reporting around small businesses who are perhaps not operating at the corporate level or even the LLC level, maybe, and who need to make some decisions around whether it's better to in some cases increase hourly wages and use that as an offset. I mean, any observations on that?
Yeah, I think it's easier for a smaller employer to make those changes than a large employer, so they're definitely the first movers.
Yeah,
I do see a trend where more employers are trying to treat all their employees equally. An employee that needs health insurance isn't necessarily more valuable to the employer than one who doesn't need health insurance. So they should be compensated based on their work, not based on their need.
Another thing that was mentioned, and there was a whole breakout session about wellness programs at the Business Alliance conference yesterday. And I wonder, from your perspective, there's some different reports about how effective they are in the end. But what is that move towards having more and more wellness programs in the workplace?
Yeah, well, we're a big believer in wellness programs. We have a sister company that does wellness programs, Workplace Vitality. And it's a growing market share. Employers are looking at ways to help their employees be healthier. And in helping them be healthier, they drive down their health cost, but more importantly, they increase productivity. If people are not absent, they're there working, productivity goes up. Wellness is also a great tool for an employer to use to help build team and help impact their culture overall. So we see a lot of employers doing that. And using healthcare dollars as incentives are a great way to do that, where we tie in how much we're going to pay towards your health premiums are tied in to a certain respect into how healthy you are, or not necessarily how healthy you are, but if you're not healthy, are you doing the right things to become healthy?
Sure. We're just going to go to callers. Callers, stay with us. Just wanted to ask you just a question around any sort of trends in retiree health benefits from amongst the membership.
Retiree health, the costs are going up significantly. The government's contribution towards Medicare Advantage plans has decreased. So it's driving up the cost significantly and created quite a bit of turmoil in that market right now.
Right. We've got a caller. Thanks for joining Innovation Friday on Connections. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, hi there. You're on Innovation Friday. Thanks very much for calling. Thanks, Jane.
Thanks. Yeah, I manage a medical practice, and I think that people are underestimating the benefits that we would receive from a single-payer system. In our practice, probably a third to maybe half of the employees here are not dealing with clinical care or providing good medical care. They're dealing with insurance companies. We're dealing with making sure we've got people have coverage, making sure we have the right policy numbers, making sure we've got pre-authorizations, making sure the patient understands what their coverage is, submitting claims, dealing with claim denials, dealing with getting payment for things from different insurance companies. And, you know, in my world, you know, Medicare is one of our best, easiest payers because everybody knows the rules. And we submit a clean claim, we get paid. So from my perspective, the private insurance companies are you know, they're taking a piece up to 20%. They're allowed by law to take up to 20% of premium dollars for administrative fees. And that, to me, seems unnecessary.
Right, so that's a really big chunk of your business efficiency, and if you're managing a medical practice, that's a real cost. That's a real cost to you that trickles down to consumers, obviously.
Right, and what we're seeing is consumers. I mean, it's also disingenuous for employers to simultaneously complain about being required to provide insurance, and also looking for ways to shove people off the employee-sponsored plans and onto the private or onto the public plans, the safety net plans. People need to be paid a decent living wage, and if you're working full-time, you should be able to access health benefits that don't force you to then apply to the safety net plans because you don't earn enough. You still qualify for Medicaid even if you work full-time. People shouldn't be complaining about the safety net plans taking too many dollars and still allowing insurance companies to not pay enough to keep people off the public plans.
Thanks, Jane. Eric, any comments to the points Jane was making?
Yeah. It's a valid point that the insurance system, the current deliverable of insurance products, there is an expense built into that. The question is, does the cost of that expense outweigh the benefit that you derive from it? If we go to a single-payer system, not all of the expense, but some of those expenses will still remain. So, you know, someone still has to pay claims, you know, which is part of that process. So we still have to file a claim. We still have to pay the doctor. We still have to track it. There's still going to be the same errors in the system, so someone has to audit those and fix those. So where there is some potential savings, there's also some inefficiencies. We don't have the motivation for people to work extra hard, which is what our current system does. You know, the capitalistic system encourages people to work hard in order to make more, in order to be more successful. And we lose some of those incentives in that single-payer system.
So I'm going to ask you a question about increases, because we've been talking prices are going up. So in 2015, according to this survey, there's different, ways that different employers in the Rochester area plan to deal with those increases. It says 44% are undecided, but there are many that are going to absorb those increases. But, I mean, what, at the end of the day, how much are we putting to our employees? How many people are sharing those? How many people are absorbing those? And, what is that increase looking like over the next year?
Yeah. I think that the majority of employers are going to pass some or all of that cost back to the employees. I think that's the general trend that's out there. We've seen employer contribution shift from the old days where it was a percentage of the benefit. We're going to pay 90% of the premium to a formula which is, we call it defined contribution method, where we're going to give the employee a flat amount of dollars and that employee is going to use those dollars to pay for their health care. Then as health care costs increase, if I'm giving an employee $3,000 to help pay for their health care and the cost goes up, in effect, the employee is paying for all of the increase at that point in time. And that becomes the challenge for the employee, is they see significant increases on the healthcare side. And in many cases, the healthcare increase is greater than the wage increase they just got. So even though they just got a raise, their net pay went down because of the cost of healthcare.
I wonder, I'm not a business owner myself, but I wonder what that process looks like when you sit down and decide, okay, I need to make an employee benefits package. What's the time that goes into that? How do you make the decisions about how much money you're going to spend overall? What are the questions that you ask yourself?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of issues that come into play. I mean, it's sitting down and you're working backwards from a budget to say, how much of this my new budget can go towards towards wages or towards benefits. And sometimes there's trade-offs. If we put it in one bucket, we don't have it available for the other bucket. Any of those decisions that the employer makes is also going to benefit some people and to a greater advantage than other people. So a lot of times the decision-making process is looking at it, where is it going to make the greatest good? So, you know, knowing that someone may come out behind, it's a tough decision. The one thing I think a lot of people don't realize is most employers, especially small employers, spend a lot of time breaking that down, not just from a theoretical standpoint, but they're looking at it at the employee level, where this is going to hurt Susie and Mike's increase. You know, he's got wife and kids, and he's not going to be able to afford that increase. I mean, they're looking at it at that level because they really care.
It's Connections Innovation Friday. Eric Bond from the Rochester Business Alliance is with us, and we have some callers. We'll take two calls, and we'll take the first one now. Thanks, John. Hi, thanks for calling Connections.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on Jane's comment, well, I think the last caller, and she was advocating for a single-payer system.
Uh-huh, yeah, Jane.
I'll tell you, it seems like she was repeating the talking points of Obamacare, the advocates for Obamacare. The fact is, when government gets involved with any type of entity, whether it's Social Security or et cetera, we've got a national debt now approaching, I think it's over $17 trillion, and government is out of control. And look what happened to the VA, which is sort of a single-payer system. Government costs and expenses and inefficiencies forever and ever, since this country's been in existence, is bankrupting our system. And the last thing we need is single payer that's controlled by the government. We need private enterprise, private companies to make this thing work, make healthcare work. And I agree with Eric that under the old system, we didn't need to completely revamp the old system. We need to just make some modifications here or there. And he brought up the point of increasing Medicaid. That would have taken care of a lot. So this is a complete, absolute obliteration of a healthcare system that was working.
Thanks for your point. So do you feel the point that I think Jane was making was just that there's an enormous amount of cost associated with administering care by having to pick up payments from a whole range of different stakeholders in any sort of healthcare transaction.
It goes back to the point, if you give the responsibility to the government, the costs are going to go up more than, she mentioned the 20%. She didn't use word skim, but she said there's a 20%. They're allowed to keep 20% of the revenues that they take in. I would submit that the government would probably increase the cost by 50 or 75%. Just look at the costs in Washington. Look at our national debt. Look at our deficits from year to year. It's absolutely out of control, and the government is so inefficient. And the private sector will get down to the bottom line through attrition, any means they can to make things efficient. And government, you have to reduce the size of government. That's our problem right now in this country.
Great. Thanks very much
for your
call. Yeah, no problem. Appreciate your call. And a much bigger conversation there to have as well around small government. Eric Bond, just to kind of wrap things up in the 5 minutes or so we've got left. What are businesses doing in terms of forward planning? How is this data then kind of driving the kind of horizon for businesses around things like investment? Is that where businesses are starting to kind of try and make decisions, based on anticipated, factors within providing healthcare?
Yeah, I think employers are trying to take a long-term strategic view from a healthcare standpoint. I think that's why many of them are moving to a defined contribution model so they can control their costs down the road. They're looking at alternate ways to deliver products. So larger employers, really those employers that are greater than 50, have some flexibility. They can move away from traditional funding models and look at things like self-funding. By moving out of the traditional system, they can save dollars. In the traditional system, about 10% of every premium dollar is going towards taxes, direct taxes, not indirect. By moving outside of that, they can see a savings right from the get-go because they don't have to pay all those taxes. So I think employers are trying to be strategic about it. They're trying to educate their employees to be better consumers. We're finding that many employers are looking more for more tools on how to educate the employees to make them better consumers, because that's really who's going to feel the brunt of it in the future.
So businesses are actually encouraging people to go out and look for some of the tools that are being developed out there for how to navigate, really.
Correct.
Right, sure.
And actually, we do a lot with employers, helping them help their employees. So the employees that do qualify for the social safety net, how do we get them enrolled in that? Many employers are now looking at the New York State of Health, the Obamacare exchange in New York, as a way to fund their health care. The biggest problem we found with that particular product or that particular concept is it doesn't really support the employee. It pushes the employee out of the employer. And many employers are taking steps. They're paying extra dollars to support their employees move into that and to be available and hire people to advise the employees on how to manage that new system as they move into it.
Right. So I just had a question around the prediction around part-time employment, because there was, and we actually did an item on the show, which looked at the current evidence about the shift towards part-time employment based on, it was a study that pulled together the available data, and it said that the expectation that there was going to be an uptick in a move to part-time employment hadn't actually happened yet. It might be something that we see moving closer to 2015, 2016. But did you see any, is that something that you also addressed in the survey, looking at the mix, the balance of part-time, say less than 30 hours a week, and full-time employment, and what sort of factor that was playing in business planning?
I think the survey did address that a little bit. It touched on who's providing benefits to part-time employees. But out in the marketplace, we see that part-time employees is a significant issue. We see some employers who are pushing, reducing hours to make sure people qualify for part-time so that they don't have to provide benefits. We've also had some employers, some employees who have intentionally reduced their coverage, especially a lower-paid employee where coverage isn't really affordable despite the fact that it may be legally affordable, where they might cut their hours so they're under 30 hours, which allows them to then go to the exchange and get a large subsidy from the state. Some employees are moving in that direction.
Right. So they've done the equation and they've realized that they're actually going to be better off with less.
Correct.
With playing into the salary, looking at the salary side of things rather than at the subsidy side of things rather than the salary side.
Correct.
Right. Sure.
Bottom line, it's made it very confusing, not only for the employers, but also for the employees trying to wade through that and evaluate all they're given options.
Because the subsidies issue is a pretty complex one anyway.
Yeah.
So, sure. Eric Bond is CEO of Bond Financial Networks and the Rochester Business Alliance. Thanks very much for being with us on Connections, Eric, and talking about the RBA's health benefits survey for 2014.
My pleasure.
We'll probably see you again next year, I would say.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break now on Connections, and we'll be back with a story about data poverty in America.
This is Michelle Faust. Join Evan Dawson on Monday for the next Connections. Evan will have President Joel Seligman of the University of Rochester talking about the future of the college, the area's largest employer. We'll have a conversation about College Town, the $100 million retail, housing, and business area just completed off Rochester's Mount Hope Avenue. It's all coming up Monday on the next Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Gallery Council of the Memorial Art Gallery, presenting the 14th Annual Fine Craft Show with limited edition and original pieces from master craft artists October 24th through the 26th. Details at mag.rochester.edu.
And thanks for staying with Connections. It's Innovation Friday. Matthew Leonard here in for Evan Dawson. And we're looking at the issue of the digital divide. The digital divide's presented numerous members of society with lots of opportunities, but it's also excluding underrepresented and impoverished communities. So we're talking about the collection of data about individuals or communities and how that data can actually empower those communities to better plan government services and participate in the digital revolution. I spoke recently with Daniel Castro. Daniel is the director of the Center for Data Innovation and the author of a new report called Data Poverty in America. He argues that that data poverty is a real factor in terms of disenfranchising underrepresented and impoverished communities, and we'll hear his thoughts now.
I mean, there's this kind of assumption, I think, sometimes that, you know, the benefits of technology and innovation just will magically happen, and the government doesn't have a role in helping foster that kind of success. And that's not true. I mean, if you look back at most technologies, government has had an important role, not only in enabling it in the first place, but also in ensuring that there's wide access to the benefits of technology. And really the same is going to be true of data and analytics and the Internet of Things and the types of benefits that we're seeing grow out of that. So if you look at something like healthcare, what we should be talking about now is the fact that a lack of data about certain populations might impact their ability to share in the benefits of data-driven approaches in healthcare. So the use of analytics to deliver personalized medicine, the use of analytics and prediction to make sure that we're having efficiencies in hospital systems or community clinics. There are these lots of opportunities where you see data being applied in healthcare, but it doesn't happen unless you have that data in the first place. And so our point here is we need to look at where these gaps are, and that there might be these data poor communities that aren't going to be able to capture these benefits.
So what are the kind of factors that you think underpin what you describe as data poor communities?
So there's a number of things that might go into this. One is certainly just access to technology. If you if you don't have a mobile device, for example, you're not going to be able to share your location information. If you're not using an activity tracker, you're not generating this kind of information about your health that might be useful. Certainly, we see this in communities and community investments and sensor-based technologies. So one community might be investing in environmental sensors and collecting data about air quality, and another won't be. And so individuals aren't able to make decisions about where is the safest place to live or the safest place to exercise or the best ways to commute to have a positive impact in their health. When you talk about the open data movement, you have access to very poor information about where is the best school in a community. You might be making your decision based on some test scores, and the test scores might be pretty old. You don't have real-time information about what's actually a good school. And so if you create a tool to pick the best school based on all these factors, that's going to be really useful in communities where you have open access to the data. That's not going to be useful in those others.
Right. So you actually found, I think, used an example in the paper that we're talking about, the rise of data poverty in America, of a school that was spending more time, achieved a greater efficiency by actually offering free lunch to the students. Could you just tell that story? I'm just trying to think of the example.
Sure. Yeah. So in Dallas, the Dallas School District, for the long time, they provided breakfast and lunch to students that they could pay for some at reduced prices. And they realized they were spending so much money paying people to collect lunch payments from kids, that they would be better off not collecting any money from students and just offering them a free lunch. They actually came out ahead financially. So once they collected that data, they could actually make that decision. And so now every student in the Dallas Independent School District can get a free breakfast and a free lunch if they want. And the school district is also saving money that they can actually spend now in the classroom. So that's the kind of improvements you get from data. And a data poor community is not able to even make those simple changes that have wins for everyone.
Right. I think you specifically talk about the potential of data to sort of assist creditors who might be able to look at financial options to support communities or particular programs in communities, and that they would be looking to quality data to sort of underpin their underwriting or decisions that they're making around finance.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at kind of where we've seen some opportunities emerge already, you can look at lending. And so with lending, the big question is always risk. How much risk is there? Because risk determines how much, the ultimate recipient of a loan would have to pay, as well as how much credit can be extended in general in a community. And so using data, you can actually significantly reduce risk because the individual receiving the information can prove something to the creditor. And the best example of this is car dealers. So if a car dealer is trying to sell a car to somebody using a loan, it's very hard to do that if you don't have any collateral. You're basically giving someone a vehicle worth a substantial amount of money, and you're trusting them to pay you back. If they stop paying you back, they could drive off with this car, and there's little you can do except try and repossess it, which takes a lot of money. Using data, you can actually track the vehicle, and then that risk really dissipates, and that has a tremendous effect on the ability to make loans then to people. So if you're, if you're low income, you don't have a lot of assets, but you got a job and you need to get to that job and you need transportation, you can use data, you can use analytics now to actually be able to purchase a car because the creditor can trust that you will in fact be honest about this because they'll be able to find the car if you stop making payments on it.
Okay. So, by definition, underrepresented and underserved communities obviously have financial challenges, both collectively and as a community. So, part of the thing, if you're talking about people having access to mobile technology, that becomes a kind of financial situation for people to be able to, access, say, a smartphone, even accessing the internet generally, as I think you point out as well, can be a challenge. So, how do you go about, overcoming some of those financial hurdles that can often be an impediment to participation?
Yeah, that's part of the challenge. You have to kind of think about where there are collective benefits that outweigh those costs and how you can, create a structure that enables investment in areas that, there is a net benefit. So it's worth making the investment, but maybe you have to kind of restructure who's spending the money and why. So, healthcare has always been a classic example of this, where the incentives for investment in quality improvements don't always align with the payer. And so you have to make structural changes so that can happen. The same is true in a lot of other areas. You want to have, if you're interested in improving healthcare, for example, you need to spend money to make sure hospitals are working well. You need to spend money to make sure that high-risk individuals can have behavioral changes that will save the community money. And so if you're only paying, for example, through charities or through government grants, if you're only paying for healthcare and not healthcare quality improvements, then you're not going to see those kinds of big changes that you want in communities. So some of this is just rethinking how we've classically approached some of these problems and saying, now that we can have data, can we use it in ways to really fix the problem and make dramatic improvements?
Is there potentially value for communities who are able to perhaps, almost in an entrepreneurial sense, generate data that they could then sell back to the government to say, look, here's all this data, this is valuable, we think this is going to lead to more efficient delivery of government services. How about you pay us for this data that we've had collected for our community?
Sure. There's certainly lots of entrepreneurship that can go into this, and one big opportunity. There's certainly a lot of schools, for example, that are failing, right? And so, a failing school district that figures out how to use data to improve itself and you know, the technology partners that they can get in the community to help them do that have a big market opportunity. You know, and the data that they generate about themselves, you know, might also be useful to lots of other individuals, and they can certainly think of ways to try and monetize that to help others. But a lot of this is really, you know, just about, you know, saying if you can't fix it if you don't know it's broken. You know, really big opportunities here for communities that can produce data to use that data, improve their services, and then, you know, sell the insights that they've gained to others, as well as, you know, just using their data and trying to monetize in other ways. That's a very important market opportunity. And certainly we see innovation happening, you know, among, you know, all types of populations. It's not something that, you know, only occurs in, you know, high-income areas, right? Once you make the data available, there's actually a lot of opportunities for communities to use it. You know, the tools necessary to analyze data, many of them are freely available online. The training to do it is freely available online. I mean, it's certainly, you know, you have to have time, you have to have, you know, resources. This isn't something that can just happen. But people do have access to it, and people especially that are in communities that are really trying to make a change and make a difference are highly motivated. And those highly motivated individuals can really do a lot with data once it's collected and made available.
Right. And there's actually a kind of a local example here in the city of Rochester where a particular neighborhood encouraged the local city to release data and block census data in a kind of interactive form so that they could use that to inform their own planning around vacant, you know, the vacant lots, that kind of thing. But that sort of, I think this is another issue that you raised recently in one of your public events, which was around the role of political will. And the, you know, the sort of the need that you can generate a kind of, I guess, passive data, if you like. You know, here's a whole block of information. So could you just talk a little bit about the role of political will in, I guess, kind of working with data in that way?
Sure. I mean, I think there's two sides of that. One is that, you know, data can generate the information and insights necessary to take action and really hold people accountable for performance and for outcomes. This is the reason that ratings on sites like Amazon and Yelp, TripAdvisor, you know, they're so important because this feedback loop really creates quality improvements. You know, whether you're talking about, you know, your local restaurant, your local school, seeing the performance and having that visible really creates accountability, and we need that. And so that's, you know, that's a huge part of, you know, kind of creating political will. The other side of this is creating political will to invest in data-driven innovations and opportunities. And you have to have leaders who see the promise of technology and are willing to be its champions. You have to see leaders who say, you know, the status quo isn't enough and we want to see change and are willing to take a little bit of risk in being pioneers in this area. You know, they have to say, we want to change our medical system. We want to change our school system. We want to increase access to everybody and take on those opportunities. And, you know, it's the same thing with corporate will. You know, businesses have to invest in these areas and get behind these initiatives as well in ways that isn't always, you know, it's a little bit risky, but it shouldn't be. I mean, right now, a lot of companies would not want to be seen as being involved with people's data because there's somewhat of a visceral reaction where people say, you know, why are you maybe looking at my information? What are you doing with my data? When they see a private company with information about them. But really, we should be saying, you know, if there's a company that, you know, is hiring data scientists, we should be saying, you know, why aren't they using all of this computing capability to really make an impact on their community? Why aren't they helping solve these major social problems that we have? Why aren't they helping, you know, cure cancer and make schools better? You know, it's not that, you know, using data science for marketing isn't useful. I mean, you know, it certainly pays the bills right now. But there's I think we need to create a culture that encourages, you know, the use of all these really powerful tools for beneficial purposes as well, right? I mean, it's not enough to build a computer so that you can, play some games. You're building these computers to really solve important social issues.
Right, and I think you're right that a lot of people do associate data with I guess, marketing or selling people something. But let's look at an example like equal employment or employment equity, which is another area where, you know, people, if companies are looking for diversity in their workplace, then data provides a mechanism perhaps to enable different hiring practices, that kind of thing.
Exactly. I mean, that's the kind of, change that you see only because people said, let's post this data out there. And, everyone, it's not that this was secret information. I mean, you could look around the workplaces in a lot of tech companies, for example, and see that there wasn't gender diversity. You can look around schools and see that there's, not racial diversity in certain fields especially. But when you put that data out there, you really start, driving the need for change. And then you have, people that are investing in tools that make the data, make the insights from the data very apparent. And that's what you want. You want people to be innovating on the use of the data. And there's so many opportunities right now that are out there. But that gets back to, this original question of you can only do that when the data is there in the first place. And so before you can have all this innovation, you have to have at least some data to begin with. We're in the early stages of adoption for everyone. But the question is, as we go forward, are there going to be communities that are left behind? And how can we make sure that they're not? Because there's so many opportunities here. We want to make sure that everyone, gets to share in those benefits.
And you've been listening to Daniel Castro in conversation with me, Matthew Leonard, on Innovation Friday on Connections. Daniel is the director of the Center for Data Innovation and the author of the report, The Rise of Data Poverty in America. Thanks for being with us on Innovation Friday. You can go to the WXXI News site, wxxinews.org, and there are links to the report that Daniel was just talking about, data poverty, under the Innovation Friday heading. And as we head towards the top of the hour, just want to encourage you to take this opportunity to contribute to your partnership with public radio, public media in the Rochester area, and call 454-6300. 454-6300. While there's still a few hours left to make your pledge, consider a level of $5 a month. $30 a month gets you a fantastic Tivoli audio radio that will enhance your experience of listening to radio, FM 91.5, AM 1370, 88.5, all part of the family of WXXI services. 454-6300, or go to wxxi.org and make a secure pledge there. Thanks for being with me, and thanks to Michelle Faust for sharing hosting duties with me as well, and Connections back at noon on Monday. Thanks for being with us. Have a good weekend.